Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Hareska, Senior Advisor for Communications and Strategy at ACS. Well, folks, the Supreme Court's term is over, finally, and we are now left to make sense of the carnage. Thankfully, I'm joined today by someone who is perfectly equipped to do just that. Ellie Misdahl is the justice correspondent and columnist for The Nation. He is also the author of the book, Allow Me to Retort. And this month, he added podcaster to his resume with the release of his new podcast, Contempt of Court. Ellie, welcome back to Broken Law.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is great to see you. And so you've added podcaster to your long resume.
Yeah, The Nation was on me pretty hard to try one. So it's called Contempt of Court. And what I'm doing, it's a limited series because, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. And what I'm doing is focusing each episode on one aspect of Supreme Court reform, right? So we're going to talk about court expansion. We're going to talk about term limits. We're going to talk about jurisdiction stripping. Each episode, I try to give an overview of like what the reform actually is, since these are terms that I think a lot of people are only recently becoming aware of, and they don't know kind of mechanically how one thing or another is supposed to work. So we kind of talk about it from a mechanical kind of scholarship level of what the actual thing is. And then we try to have a political lens. I try to bring on some political guests to tell us how close we are to actually seeing any of these reforms implemented, right? So like, for instance, for the ethics episode, which hasn't dropped yet, we talk a little bit about, you know, obviously the need for Supreme Court ethics reforms, what the different proposals are. Then we bring on Hank Johnson, the congressman from Georgia, who has the ethics bill in the House, and talk to him about, like, you know, the likelihood of passage. So it's that kind of show. Hopefully it will be informative for people who are kind of only recently coming to the game of court reform. Obviously, I have been in it quite some time.
And hopefully our listeners are pretty up to date on it, but it's always worthwhile to hear more, and certainly to hear kind of the current political dynamics.
Hope so.
Hopefully you give a little bit of hope, because especially right now, it feels very cynical at times to be talking about court reform.
Well, you know, right now it's our problem is that the elected leaders in the Democratic Party still do not feel like court reform is necessary. You know, you talk to Dick Durbin and he'll say, we're not there yet. I mean, I don't know what has to happen to get him there. Like, I don't know what other rights have to be taken away before he gets there, but for whatever reason, he's not there yet. You know, President Biden, he says, like, oh, well, we don't want to politicize the court. Like, did you see what just happened? Like, I think that horse has left the barn.
You can't politicize this court anymore.
The court has already done politicized itself. So the question is, are we ever going to fix it? And so we still have a lot of work to do with the elected leaders. But I think that the people on the ground, they're starting to come around to the idea that something needs to be done.
Can I ask you, though, in terms of political will by politicians, is the issue that they don't think SCOTUS reform is needed yet, or they think they're going to get hit politically if they try?
I think for different politicians, the answer is different. I think there are some politicians who honestly don't think that we need it yet, which is a position that I can't understand, but I think that there are some people who...
That seems to be where the president
who kind
is.
Of genuinely hold that position, right? Then I do think that, you know, they're political animals, and I do think that they are, you know, and this really goes to, like, one of the overall reasons for why liberals have lost the court, right? Like, I feel like conservatives kind of have always understood that the court was politics by other means. And they've attacked...
It's a third legislative branch. It just legislates differently. Right?
And they've proceeded from that assumption for 40 years. This is not something that's new. This goes back to Bork, right? Like, they have understood for a generation that to get the kind of cultural conservative victories that they want, they can't have it without controlling the Supreme Court. And so they've attacked it like a political institution. Liberals, for the most part, certainly elected Democrats, for the most part, have treated it like it is some above the fray nonpartisan institution, right? Democrats already generally self-select for institutionalists. And we have a lot of those people who were elected to higher office. And so they are, I think, wrongheadedly really wrapped up in the idea that the Supreme Court is so powerful and so awesome. And that's the way that it should be. And any attempt to change it will have, you know, downstream negative effects on the functioning of the polity. And I just, It's not just that they're wrong. It's that they proceed from a really, I think, false premise about what the court has been historically. And I think they proceed from a false premise in terms of who the court is actually hurting, right? Like, if you're a white, cis-hetero male, I'm sure the court seems pretty moderate to you.
You're doing right? Great. This court is in your corner.
Your rights aren't on the chopping block, right? Yeah. It's everybody else who is suffering under this current conservative supermajority. And I just think that there are very few elected Democrats who have that, who understand, quite frankly, what's at stake and for who it's at stake too.
And it's not just the Supreme Court. I think there's increased frustration, certainly from ACS, about the Senate's commitment to judges, period. Right. The refusal to eliminate the blue slip, the sense of like, we're taking our time in confirming judges. We're just going to go at a pace that kind of suits us. No rush.
Again, it's institutionalism all the way down, right? Like the senators are consumed with the idea of being fair to other senators, as opposed to being consumed by the idea to being fair to the citizens. Right. And that is the grand disconnect. When these senators say, like, oh, my friend from across the aisle, they mean that. That's not just a platitude. They're buds. They hang out. They go to dinner together. They exist in the same bubble together. And they're more committed to that togetherness. Many of them are more committed to that togetherness than they are to doing the work of the American people. And that, and especially when doing the work of the American people means stopping their friends from across the aisle from hurting people, right? Like they don't see that as part of their job. I see it as part of their most essential function. And so that's how you get into this idea about blue slips and how, you know, at one point Durbin said, you know, we've made it work. No, you haven't. The Republicans have obstructed Biden nominees up and down the Fifth Circuit. You haven't made it work. You can't get a judge confirmed in Texas. And if you do, it's got to be the most moderate, the most, you know, mealy mouth kind of person you can find. That's not getting it done. That's not making it work. That's caving to the Republican obstructionism is what he's doing. Do people care about that? Are people going to vote on that is the real issue. One of the things that I've said is that one of the reasons why Republicans have won the Supreme Court and won the judiciary is because their voters will not vote for a primary candidate who is soft on courts. I mean, I go all the way back to Donald Trump, and he's down the escalator, and he's talking about Mexicans, and he's talking about all the, and he's insulting people, and he's threatening to beat people up. And then it comes to the Supreme Court, and he's like, here's my list. From Leonard Leo.
Well, and that's now routine, right? We're seeing it again now in the primary, that releasing lists of potential SCOTUS nominees, that's now standard.
Whereas there is yet to be a Democrat for Senate or for the presidency who has lost a primary based on their softness on the Supreme Court, right? Biden was the most opposed to Supreme Court reform of the entire presidential field in 2020, and it didn't cost him a vote, as far as I can tell, right? And so until Democrats start losing, until Dick Durbin gets primary challenged and loses a primary challenge on his leadership of the judiciary, Democrats are going to keep doing what they're doing.
So one of the issues on this that you mentioned previously is that there are still a lot of Democrats who see the Supreme Court as this like holy institution, right? That sits apart from politics. It's up high upon this hill, and thou shalt not criticize or touch. And we're still trying to get folks to understand that this is a third political branch. It's a third partisan branch. It needs to be covered like a partisan political branch. And you've been one of the most outspoken members of the press, I think, in trying to get mainstream media to cover the Supreme Court like it covers Congress. And I want to give you a chance to elaborate on that, because I feel like each term there's minor progress made on this, but we still have a long ways to go.
Yeah. So there, to me, there are two huge problems with how the media covers the court, right? One you've hit on, we cover it as an institution above the political fray, as opposed to an institution that's all up in the mix, right? So, you know, I've made the point, Lindsey Graham cannot walk through an airport without being heckled. Like, can't do it from both sides at this point, actually, right? Lindsey Graham is a famous person in our system, right? The ranking member now of the Judiciary Committee, right? John Roberts, the Chief Justice at the Supreme Court, could be in line behind at the Whole Foods for most of the Washington press corps, and they wouldn't know who they were talking to. They wouldn't know who's behind them. Like, they cannot pick John Roberts out of a lineup, much less cover him like the political actor he is. John Roberts is, if not the most powerful Republican in the country, because that's probably still Mitch McConnell, he's the second most powerful Republican in the country, right? And most people wouldn't recognize him at the Publix. That is a complete failure of our media to just cover these guys, to just cover just what these people are doing, where these people are going. You know, another aspect of this is, like, look at all of the hopefully soon to be Pulitzer Prize winning work from ProPublica, right? Mm-hmm. What is that really saying, though? What ProPublica is really saying is that mainstream media, y'all haven't been doing the job. Because
that's the coverage I would like to see more of mainstream media covers, or is dedicate investigative time and journalism to Supreme Court justices, the same way that they reveal all of the donors that fund politicians. Mm-hmm. Clearly, justices have billionaire benefactors too.
Right. And the reason why ProPublica's report has been so earth-shattering is because the mainstream media dropped the ball and wasn't looking in on their financial disclosures and wasn't thinking about who these people were talking to and wasn't tracking, wasn't following the money when it came to the Supreme Court justices. I mean, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse has been there with, you know, a poster board for 10 years trying to get people to do it. But, you know, the New York Times hasn't been, right? And ProPublica ate their lunch, and now you see the New York Times, oh, Horatio Alger Society. Oh, now welcome to the party, New York Times, right? But it's taken ProPublica to, like, show. So that's kind of one general failure, right? The second general failure is a little bit more subtle and a little bit harder to fix. Like, the first failure, they could fix by just caring, and they don't, right? But the second,
dedicating staff time, dedicating personnel.
Just putting some resources behind reporting on these people, they could fix the first problem. The second problem is a little bit more subtle, and it goes to the nature of the law, which is unfortunately complicated. I do everything I can in my, you know, writing and media and whatever to demystify and decomplicate some of these issues, but they are fundamentally complicated. And if that's not bad enough, they are, the nature of our legal system is an adversarial one, which means there's always another side, right? There's always a both sides argument. So we have a media that's already failing on these both sideism kind of stories, right? When it comes to, you know, political actions and Trump and whatever, well, the court is designed to be both sides, right? And so no matter what the court rules on, no matter how outrageous or extremist or whatever, of course there's another side to the argument. And all the media can do, without the legal training, without the kind of critical ability to parse some of these rulings, all they can do is print the warring press releases, right? John Roberts says this, Ketanji Brown Jackson says that. Who can tell? You know, and they leave it like that. And so they don't do a really poor job of even explaining what the court is doing and why, in part because a lot of the people in the media don't understand it. I've the analogy that I've made, it's like the people who cover the Supreme Court for most mainstream outlets could easily be the same people who cover NASA for most mainstream outlets, right? You got people who don't have a degree in rocket science.
Like, wow, look, the rocket took off.
It's in space. Yeah. Like, and and that's how they cover it. And then you can imagine how complicated it would be if there was, like, an alien presence that was also just like, actually, that's a bad rocket. And all the, well, Zorg says that this rocket is not what humans should be doing right now. And that would be the press coverage, right? Because they don't actually have the technical skills to tell us kind of, you know, with any kind of authority, hey, that rocket ain't doing so well. I know it's in space, but it's not doing so well, right? They have no technical ability. Similarly with the Supreme Court, they've got no technical ability to be like, yeah, this is John Roberts' argument. It's very bad. And we can, yeah. And here's how we can know that it's very bad. You know, so when you look at, you know, to bring it into like a current case, you look at the affirmative action case, right? If your listeners haven't yet read it, please go read Adam Sewer's article.
We'll link to it in the show notes for this
about one. Clarence Thomas's concurrence in the affirmative action case, where Clarence Thomas just straight up said the Freedmen's Bureau was a race neutral term. And that is bollocks. That is bunk on its face.
It is making up history. Right?
But like, if you looked at all of the initial reporting about the affirmative action case, nobody even mentioned it. People just took it at face value. It was like, oh, well, Thomas says it's a race neutral term. No, it's not. And Sutter had to write 3,000 words explaining why it's not. But it's also the kind of thing that like should have been in the New York Times write up. Oh, by the way, Clarence Thomas just straight up lied, right? This is the problem. They don't have the kind of technical skills to point out when the justices are straight up lying, straight up making up facts, straight up making up law.
Which is happening more and more. I feel like increasingly we have cases that are based on hypotheticals where standing is manufactured. Like, we're just manufacturing the cases to justify the decision.
Sometimes I don't know if Neil Gorsuch is writing Supreme Court opinions or the Canterbury Tales 2, because he is in complete fiction mode now twice in 2 years, right? In the Kennedy v. Bremerton case, the one with the praying football coach,
yep.
Gorsuch just made up a set of facts that was not true about how and where and why the coach was praying. Just made up a case and then ruled on that made up case. And I'm sure that sounds reasonable to a lot of people if you believe the case that he made up that just had nothing to do with the facts on the ground. And then certainly this year with 303 Creative v. Lannis, I mean, we've got a completely fake case, a case that is facially not right, with a woman who does not have a business, is not entered into a business, has no customers.
I love that. Has no customers, but...
And yet they rule on her. Yeah. And I just want to, for your listeners, just really put a pin in that point, because like it's I'm not angry at it just because I don't agree with the decision. Like,
yeah.
One of the reasons why they make up these cases and why they make up facts is because if you actually had to deal with a plaintiff who had harm, most of Gorsuch's arguments go away. Like, he can't actually make the argument that she is not denying services based on people's sexual orientation if you had a person who was LGBTQ who was denied services by her, and they could explain to the court exactly what they asked for and exactly what she did not do. That would get to the heart of whether or not her alleged fictional, fantastical business was creative or not. To make this distinction now in the case without having a factual record means that we are just wish casting what creativity and speech might be, as opposed to dealing with an actual case. So when the court makes up facts, it's not just, it's not a technical point, right? It's not just a sour grapes technical point. It actually means that you can't have a reasonable decision because it's not based on a real fact pattern.
Well, hypotheticals, the value is they're hypothetical, which means that you can write them and craft them the way that suits your narrative, as opposed to a defined case with a defined set of facts that come your way that you have to deal with.
For Neil Gorsuch, the only people who aren't hypothetical are Native Americans, right? Native Americans, he's pretty sure are real. Like, I think he might have met one at some point. And so he's like, oh, I know that guy, right? But everybody else, we just exist in every other non-white, non-cis hetero person. We just exist as a theory in Neil Gorsuch's mind. And he can theoretically take away our rights as he sees fit.
So the other aspect that came up this term is we're also seeing a court that even if it doesn't validate some extreme legal fantasies, right, like the independent state legislature theory, it will still take the case. It still hangs a sign above the door that says open for business to whatever extreme fiction you want to present. Talk to me about that danger, because even if you get a decision that isn't as bad as it could be, right, that some people will label a win or as a moderate decision, you still have to address the fact that the court took the case.
Yeah, so this is a soapbox I've been preaching since 2018, since Brett Kavanaugh ascended to the court. There are tons of problems with Brett Kavanaugh, just tons, yeah. Right? But on this particular point, I said it at the time, and I don't think that it's gotten enough play even since then. Going from Kennedy to Kavanaugh, gave the arch conservatives, I call them the four horsemen, that critical fourth vote. And people need to understand why four votes is so important.
As opposed to five.
Because with four votes, that's what the Supreme Court needs to grant cert, right? That's what the Supreme Court needs to decide to hear a case. It doesn't have to be a majority of the court. It has to just be a minority of the court, four. And when you added Kavanaugh to Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, you then got the fourth vote to hear any craziness, any foolishness. Anybody who's on the right wing with a hope and a dream and a pen can make an appeal to the Supreme Court and have a reasonable chance of having it get heard, right? No matter how ludicrous, outside the box, whatever that theory is. So the problem with this is twofold. One, as you say, it encourages the crazies, right? It puts a sign on First Street that says, you know, nutbags welcome. That's what this does, because everybody is now trying to figure out how to get their crazy wackadoodle fake case theory in front of the Supreme Court. And they know that they've probably got four votes to hear it, right? So that's problem number one. Problem number two, even when they turn it down, when they take the case and they hear it and they dismiss it on the merits, what does that really do? All it does is give the crazies a roadmap for the next case.
And some of the decisions explicitly say, like, not this time, but come back to us with a different set of facts.
And this then is the other huge, I mean, again, there are many problems with Brett Kavanaugh, but then this then becomes my biggest kind of professional problem with Brett Kavanaugh. All he does is write concurrences that are two pages long, very short, very poorly written, that explicitly say, here's the kind of case I'd like to hear next. Kavanaugh, literally from his position as a Supreme Court justice, advocates for the kinds of cases he wants to hear.
It is judicial advocacy. You're right. It is him lobbying for the next case.
In the past, it used to be in the dicta, right? It used to be like you'd read like a Stephen Breyer opinion and be like, oh, there's a footnote here. I wonder if that means Breyer's a little bit more open to overturning the death penalty than other. Like, you'd have to really kind of think. Kavanaugh just straight up says, next time, please bring this and we'll see.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's boorish is what it is. But it's also, as you say, it's direct judicial advocacy for him to get the kinds of cases he wants to hear in order to do the horrible things he wants to do. And that's the other aspect that happens when they take up these crazy cases. Even if the crazy case itself is not the one that gets through, the next one down the road, right, or the next one down the road might. And for evidence of that, you just have to look at Trump v. Hawaii.
Yeah.
Remember, people forget, Roberts gave Trump three cracks at the Muslim ban. Right. The first two ones were just off the wall, cockadoodle do. And then finally, the third one, Robert's like, yes, you've done what I said. You have given me a Muslim ban that I can vote for. And now you can ban Muslims. They gave Trump three bites at the apple to get to the Muslim ban. That's going to be the exact same thing with some of these other more ridiculous anti-democratic theories floating around there. They're just going to come back to Kavanaugh being like, yo, Brett, we did what you said. Vote for us now, and he might.
And it's also, I think, sending a signal to lower court judges, because we're also starting to see more and more ludicrous decisions coming up from the district court, noticeably from a few specific district courts.
The Fifth Circuit is just YOLO right now. They are fire festival off the chain right now. And what it is that I think is really disturbing is that what you see is certain judges openly auditioning to be the next Republican Supreme Court appointee, most likely when Clarence Thomas retires, right? You've got Kyle Duncan on the Fifth Circuit. You've got James Ho on the Fifth Circuit. And you've got Naomi Rao on the D.C. Court of Appeals. All three of those can be seen to be openly auditioning for Clarence Thomas's job. And the way they're auditioning for it is to be as crazy as possible. And that is what is being rewarded, right? Matthew Kazimark, who's only a district court now judge now, is auditioning to be the Fifth Circuit replacement.
Oh, I think he's auditioning for the Supreme Court. Like, maybe he has to take a step before getting there, but he's got his eye on the prize.
But at first, he has to replace Ho or Duncan or whoever on the Fifth Circuit. So that's the next promotion that he's looking for. But you have judges who are careerists.
Yeah.
And who are writing opinions to further their own Republican bona fides. And the way to do that right now is to be as crazy as possible. And that's what we're seeing across lower court circuits, but especially the wackadoodle Fifth Circuit, which just, I mean, that you want to talk about court expansion. I mean, I'd put 20 judges on the Fifth Circuit tomorrow if I was Joe Biden and Dick Durbin. Like, you want to not deal with the Supreme Court because you don't want to politicize. Give me 20 extra Fifth Circuit judges now. Because yeah. That circuit is out of control.
And it goes back to the politicization, right? Of like that tryout notion. What does that look like? It looks like a young politician who's like, I'm going to start in the state legislature, and then I'm going to move to Congress, and then I'm going to look to the USN, and then I'm going to look to the White House. It is the exact same kind of promotional trend.
Yep. And it's something that, you know, that Leonard Leo encourages, quite frankly. Like, it's something that the Federalist Society encourages, that they do well. You know, I like to say to people, you know, people like Neil Gorsuch are not born, they're made. They're molded and shaped and sculpted throughout their careers.
Just like politicians are.
You know, Leo with his, you know, like the evil angel on the shoulder, always pointing the right way. Same with Amy Coney Barrett. Amy Coney Barrett is Supreme Court justice because she got hit by Dianne Feinstein in a confirmation hearing. Right. And it made her famous amongst the religious right. That's why she's there. She wasn't the leader in the clubhouse to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg 2 years before she replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she got hit by Dianne Feinstein and that made her popular. The way to get popular in conservative circles is to say something so crazy, so outlandish, and so extremist that people like me get pissed off. And that makes you a hero to them, right? And that's
you
that's
get to play Kingmaker in this weird way.
I try to ignore Ho, right? I try because like I know I just try to ignore him because like he doesn't need that kind of, you know, press, right? But you know, William Pryor, another one who was out there openly auditioning, making jokes. Bill Pryor's made jokes about me and Adam Serwer and Ian Millhiser on the stump at the Federalist Society. This is sitting district as a court of appeals judge auditioning to be on the Supreme Court someday. So like how you get famous in those circles is part of the problem with the court. But again, I go back to Biden's, you know, we don't want to politicize the court. Like what do you think is happening? What do you think has already done happen? And the question is not, you know, it's like, it's the line from Lord of the Rings, right? War is upon you, whether you would have it or not. Right. You might not want to politicize the court, but it has been politicized. The question is what we're going to do about it.
Yeah, and whether you're going to do anything or just let them continuously win.
Win.
I mean, that's what this is. It's effectively like winning an election, winning control of Congress. In fact, right now, you'd rather have control of the court.
Only when you win it once, you win it for 40 years.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like these people, I talk to young people a lot, and I try to make them understand there is not a thing that they care about that can be fixed as long as they let Republicans control the Supreme Court, right? There's no changes coming to gun safety laws. There's no changes coming to environmental protection or climate change laws. Nothing happens until these six people die off. And that's 30, 40, 50 years in the future.
Yeah, I always worry about phrasing it in partisan terms, because it can't be the Democratic Party wants to control the court, right? The goal has to be to somehow restore legitimacy to it, which means expanding it.
It's to me, it's not so much about the Democrats controlling the court. It is about the citizens controlling the court.
Yeah.
Right? The idea that we have three branches of government. Two of them are elected, and those two are somehow not as powerful as the one that's unelected.
Yeah, and that's the legitimacy argument, that you have an institution right? that is completely run amok.
We have a Supreme Court right now that executes a veto power over the two elected branches of government, which is not how it's supposed to be.
And legislates. I mean,
there is not, and you saw this term with the student debt case, right? There is not a major piece of legislation that is real until the Supreme Court passes off on it, right? Obamacare wasn't real until Roberts converted it to a tax. It wasn't a tax. It was a use of the commerce power, but Roberts doesn't like the commerce power, so he converted it to a tax. But that's what made Obamacare real. The fact that it got 60 freaking votes in the Senate and was signed by the president didn't make it real until Roberts said it was okay.
Yeah.
The student loan crisis, same thing. Biden had the votes. He had the power. He had the authority from Congress. Roberts said, nope, wasn't real. And so guess what? Now you can't have student debt relief, right? Because Roberts said so. That's how it works, and that's not how it's supposed to work. We're supposed to have electoral control over our rules and laws and regulations, not have it handed down to us from on high by 9 unelected, unaccountable people.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. ACS is a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization committed to protecting our democratic legitimacy and supporting laws and legal systems that improve the lives of all people. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. Our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By joining ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, our advocacy in support of Supreme Court reform and truth, racial healing, and transformation, and so much more. You also become a member of our nationwide network, which includes over 250 student and lawyer chapters. Join ACS and the progressive legal movement today by visiting our website at acslaw.org/membership. And now back to the conversation.
I want to get into reform and get your thoughts on kind of the latest conversation on that. But first, can I just ask you something? The term is over, right? SCOTUS is on hiatus now for a few months. What is your summation of this past term for somebody who hasn't been tracking it and goes, so what happened?
Whites win again. it's you know, new story, same conclusion. If you are a wealthy white male, you won. And if you are anybody else, you lost. If you were a worker, you lost. You basically lost a significant part of your ability of your right to strike, right? If you're a woman, well, you lost last year, and you and you're still losing, right? LGBTQ, you lost. Racial minority, you lost. Anybody who wasn't a cis hetero white male lost this term, and that's how it's gonna be going forward, right? So like the you know, there were a lot of pre-written articles the second to last week of the term because of Moore v. Harper, right? Because they pushed back the absolutely democracy destroying cuckoo for cocoa puffs idea of the independent state legislature theory. And that coupled with the decision in the voting rights case, Milligan, which honestly did surprise me. That made a lot of, again, white cis hetero males say like, oh, see, the court is tacking moderate, right? And they wrote those articles before the last week, and then didn't update them when the court did its dirty stuff in the very last 2 days of its term, as everybody knew they would. So that's the story of the term. That was the story of last term. That was the story of the term before that. That's going to be the story of next term. Like that is the story. They've been. I was trying to explain to some people how I was so sure that affirmative action was going to lose in front of the Supreme Court, and I was like, well, because they've been trying to kill it for 40 years and they have the votes to do it.
I mean, it was on the list just like Roe was, right? It's been one of their long pursuits.
Like, why would you think that finally having the ability to kill the thing that they wanted to kill, that they were sent to First Street to kill, and now they had an opportunity and they weren't going to kill it? No, they're going to kill it because that's why they were there. Same with Roe, as you said. And pretty soon it's going to be the same with gay marriage.
So given all that, what did you make of the voting rights case? Because Chief Justice John Roberts hates the Voting Rights Act. That is long established. And you would have thought any opportunity to further obliterate it, he would have taken. So was this just him being like, you know, guys, like, we can't do it all in one term. Slow your roll. Just for 1 year.
Look, again, I was shocked because, as you say, John Roberts has voted against the Voting Rights Act his entire professional career. This is the Milligan case is the first time that anybody can point to where John Roberts has done something other than take a mallet to the Voting Rights Act, right? Why? Well, because the way that he took the mallet to it leaves John Roberts as the person in charge of voting, right? And that's a huge way to understand this case. If the Alabama racist legislatures had won, that would have said that basically any state legislature can make up its racist voting maps however they want, right? And that would work for red states, but that would also work for blue states. By disagreeing with Alabama, by dismissing their complaint, by overruling them, what John Roberts has set up is that he, John Roberts, actually gets to control what is important, isn't important in voting. John Roberts gets to tell us how much racism is or isn't allowed in voting. I think a huge mistake that Alabama made in retrospect was its reliance on computer simulations, right? They kept saying like, oh, our maps are not racially discriminatory because here are 2,000 computer simulations, 2 million computer simulations, 250 million, and it says that we can do that. And John Roberts, if you know his history, John Roberts hates computers. He hates the math, right? And he hates being told that a judicial decision is compelled by math. We saw that in Rucho. We saw that in Gil v. Whitford. We see again and again that John Roberts resists the idea that math cables his power. Alabama, trying to get away from the criticisms of racism, heavily relied on math, heavily relied on those computers. And I think that was actually ultimately what got them in trouble, so that Roberts and Kavanaugh, to a certain extent, were both like, no, we get to decide what's racist, not a computer.
Well,
you know, Roberts devotes a whole section in his opinion in Milligan to how much he hates computers and how, I think he says, like, oh, the plaintiffs rely heavily on the fact that they ran 2 million computer simulations, but there are potentially a trillion computer simulations that you can run. How many are necessary before, you know, it's a good point, I guess, if you're John Roberts and you want to be in control of things. But it's significant that he, again, devoted an entire bit of his argument just to knocking down the computer simulation evidence presented by the state of Alabama. So I don't think that it's indicative of some larger come to Jesus moment with Roberts and the Voting Rights Act. I don't think that he looks at his decision in Shelby County as the worst decision of his career, although it is the worst decision of his career. I'm going to be pissed when it's not in the first paragraph of his obituary, because it won't be, because a white guy will write his obituary. I don't think he is backed off of his position in Shelby County. I don't think he's backed off of his position in Brnovich, which was the other Section 2 voting rights case from 2021. But I do think that he doesn't like computers, and I do think that he wants to be the final say on what is or is not illegal in the context of the 15th Amendment.
Interpreting it as kind of a power grab or a power retention would also then apply to Moore v. Harper, where yes, they rejected the most extreme version of the independent state legislature theory, but there was also this sense of like, yes, but we also have this watchful eye over state courts and we're going to have the final word.
100%. That is the right interpretation of Moore v. Harper. And that's why I wasn't surprised with Moore v. Harper, right? I was surprised with Milligan because even though I understand that John Roberts hates computers, he hates black people voting more. So I didn't know who was going to win in that kind of cage match. But the independent state legislature theory was a direct affront to the Supreme Court's power. And I thought there was no way that Roberts would go for it. The one that surprised me there a little bit was Kavanaugh, just because independent legislature theory is his baby. Kavanaugh was the one on CNN advocating for independent state legislature theory back in 2000 when he was a lawyer for Bush and Bush v. Gore. So I was a little bit surprised that they got Kavanaugh's vote on that, but I wasn't surprised by Roberts at all because, again, Roberts, if there's one thing Roberts cares about, it's maintaining the power of himself and his court. And Moore v. Harper wouldn't have allowed him to do that had they gone for the cockamamie independent state legislator theory.
To me, one of the most telling moments in terms of Roberts was actually on the last day when, towards the very end of his opinion in the affirmative action case, he really comes out and wants to criticize other justices for critiquing the court and has this like, guys, we need to speak kindly of our institution, lest we suggest to the public that there is something wrong with our magnificent institution.
Yeah, that is, to me, that's white guy 101, right? We gotta be nice when we're, even though I have my foot on your neck, we can still be civil about it, right? Even though I am taking away your rights, taking away your ability to be full and equal participants in the society, there's no reason for harsh language. That's the kind of mentality that you have and that you can only have when you're privileged and when these people aren't coming for you. It's you know, Alito did the same thing. Alito, of all freaking people, did the same thing. Alito, who will run, who obviously has the Wall Street Journal editorial board on speed dial. And, you know, I imagine that, like, he just calls them up at, like, you know, 10 o'clock at night. You're being mean to me again. Why?
That was fascinating exchange of, like, to have a justice who suddenly has a PR team that can be whipped into shape in 24 hours.
Right? Like, Alito, but Alito's all like, oh, we must not be disagreeable, whatever the hell he's at. Like, it comes from an amazing seat of privilege to think that even criticizing you is somehow damaging to your institutional prerogatives. But that's where they are. You know, there was an Onion article.
The Onion is starting to feel very real.
Right? So there was a satire, and if you don't know, you don't know how you don't know, but the Onion is satire. But the headline of the article was, Supreme Court, we wear crowns now. And that's...
Again, that just feels very on the nose.
That's kind of how they are, right? Like they have called upon themselves such prerogatives, such prestige, and such power that you can almost see them wearing crowns at this point, right? You can almost see, and thinking that it was a good idea.
Yeah. Then it's just a gentle reminder about who they are and the stature that they bring.
Exactly. Like, you know, not them wearing crowns in this kind of like, in this kind of proud, like, look, see the crown? So like, everybody chill. We've got this, you know, one laurel wreath for every right we've taken away. What's the problem here? It's they need to be cut down to size. And this is, again, the way to cut them down to size is to massively expand the Supreme Court. Because what you do if you expand the Supreme Court is that you generally, if you do a court expansion and nothing else, and I am an all of the above reformer. But what you do in the first instance with court expansion is that before you can address the power that the institution has, you address the power of each individual member. And that is like just a lesson that like the Roberts and Alitos of the world need right now, that they alone are not so goddamn important and self-important, right? And so like going to 13 justices decreases their power individually, even before you get into the other reforms that we might want to do to decrease the power of the institution. They themselves need to be chopped down to size.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that I think court expansion is the most important thing in terms of rectifying the outrageous power grab that this court is undertaking. Because it's also, you mentioned this earlier, that you have maybe McConnell, but I would argue the 9 most powerful people in the country are 9 unelected judges who have life tenure, which means mm-hmm. they more or less can do no wrong. And they know that they're acting that way. And if you're going to have an unelected institution with that much power, you should not have so few of them.
Right. It's if they're going to act like a super legislature, then they need to be staffed like a super legislature, at least, right? Like,
there's a reason that there are 400 plus members of Congress,
right? Like there are 435 members of Congress. There are 100 senators. If you're going to act like that, then we need 100 of you. If that's the kind of power you want to wield, right? And you've got to be replaceable, right? Because one of the things we know from history is that absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? So, like, if you are going to give these people this much power, they can't hold it for the rest of their natural lives. And they can't know they're going to hold it for the rest of their natural lives, because when they hold it for the rest of their natural lives and they know it, that's how you end up with Clarence Thomas. Like, that's how you end up with Sam Alito. That's how you end up with these corruption scandals and stories. Because what can anybody do to them? People forget, and I keep slamming on Brett Kavanaugh because he's the worst, but people forget that there were 83 ethics complaints that got thrown out without a hearing, without an investigation against Brett Kavanaugh, simply because he was elevated to the Supreme Court. And once he got to the Supreme Court, there was nothing the lower court judge could do to hold him accountable. That's ridiculous.
When you envision court expansion, because there's different approaches to this in terms of what the ultimate outcome is that you're trying to achieve, are you looking for a system where we have a higher number of justices and they all sit on all cases? Or are you looking at a higher number of justices, a panel of which randomly selected decide cases?
Oh, I am all about the panel system. I am all about those three.
So no panels, justice which, has a guarantee of deciding any one case.
Which is one huge issue when it comes to corruption. When you go to the Supreme Court, you should not know which justices you're going to get.
Which is how the lower courts work.
Right? Which is how literally every court of appeals in the country works. It's how every district court in the country works. You don't know that you're going to get Eileen Cannon to handle your criminal investigation case. You have to get lucky for that to happen. Right? Like, you shouldn't know which crazy conservatives are going to hear your case before you bring it. And I promise you that if you didn't know which judges were hearing it, it would make people bring more reasonable cases. Yeah. It's as simple as that. You don't bring independent state legislature theory when you don't know if you're going to end up with a panel of Sotomayor, Kagan, and Roberts. You just don't do it.
Yeah, because you're going to lose. You have to be able to make an argument to any panel that gets selected. Right?
And then, for even if we stay at nine, and I don't think we should stay at nine, but even if we stay at nine, think about what that does in terms of en banc review, in terms of having the full circuit hear it. Well, if you look at the Court of Appeals, what do we get to have to overturn a panel decision? We need a majority, not a minority. So it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the difference between number four and five, right? Like, if you right now, to get the full court to hear your case, you only have to convince four judges. If you had a panel system and didn't expand the court at all, you would at least need to have five justices agree to hear a case over an appeal of a lower court of the three-judge panel, right? Which, again, if you look at the history of the of how the circuits do it, right, it's not that en banc never happens. But it happens a whole lot more rarely than the three-judge ruling, right? Most of the time, the three-judge ruling is the one that stands, because when you overturn the three-judge ruling, what you're saying to your colleagues is just like, oh, you guys got it wrong. And usually that only happens for like a big ticket item, a big ticket issue. So just on its, before we even talk about expansion, just putting it into panels, if not actually increasing the credibility and legitimacy of the court, certainly the perception of credibility and legitimacy is slightly restored when the judges hearing the case are assigned by random lot.
The point that I always want to bring up when we talk about changing the size of the court is it's actually happened very recently. People think that it hasn't happened for over 100 years, but lo and behold, if you go back just a few years, we had eight justices on the court for more than a year.
Mitch McConnell changed the size of the Supreme Court as long as a Democrat was president. That was his plan. That's what he did. That's what he said he was going to do.
That's a method of court reform. He reformed the court. He reduced it to eight.
He took away a justice for as long as a Democrat was president, right? But even beyond that, look, yes, the court has expanded many times over the past. We started at six. We went to seven. We went to nine. We went to 10. We went back down to seven. Then we went to nine. And then I always like to bring up this issue of FDR and court packing, because everybody says, oh, even FDR, the most powerful president, even he failed at court packing. Did he really, though? Did he fail? Because if you look at it, FDR was losing cases at the Supreme Court before he threatened to expand it. Then he's threatened to expand it. Then, miraculously, he starts winning cases at the Supreme Court, right? He was losing 5-4. Then Owen Roberts, no relation to Chief Justice John Roberts, changes his mind. They call it the switch in time that saved 9. Now, I understand there's a legal scholarship debate about whether or not Owen Roberts changed because of the court packing plan or not, or if he just, like, I don't know, was visited by an angel and decided that, like, actually people need bread. I don't know. I don't know the man. I can't say. What I can say is that I would love to be a failed court reformer in the mold of FDR. Because if you look at his failure, what happened was that he was losing and then he started winning. And his agenda, the one that he was democratically elected to implement, started getting passed, started passing muster, started going through. I would love to live in a world where the president that we vote for gets to enact policies.
And again, that happened by having a president talk about the Supreme Court, not with a like very hands-off approach, with a quite literal hands-on, I am ready to take action approach. And so it goes back to how we started this conversation, talking about how elected officials are approaching the court, but it also goes to how the media is covering the court. I do think that those are reinforcing one way or the other, that the media needs to be critical to help explain to politicians what it means to be critical of the court.
I think also politicians have just gotten very used on blaming the court for things that they don't want to have to be responsible for doing. You know, I think for a long time, Republicans, oh, we would love to be bigoted to gay people, but oh, that pesky Supreme Court, what can we do? Anyway, here's some tax cuts. Like, you know, that was the, you know, for a long time, Democrats was like, oh, abortion, it should be safe, legal, and rare. And but you know, the Supreme Court, what can you do? Right. Like there was a lot of passing the buck to the Supreme Court from politicians who didn't want to take tough votes, you know, who didn't want to codify Roe v. Wade, who didn't want to pass a national abortion rights amendment because like that might make people sad. Right. So they didn't do the hard work. They wanted to pass the buck off to the Supreme Court. And all of that buck passing, I think, has caught up with us as a nation in the last 23 years. You know, people say like when. Like I start the clock on this court is out of control. I don't start it in with Dobbs, you know. I don't even start it with Citizens United. I start it with Bush v. Gore because that was the time the Supreme Court picked the president.
The decision that helped inspire the creation of ACS.
They picked the president on a straight partisan vote. That's wrong. And that is where we all went wrong. To me, that is when we went through the wormhole and ended up in Earth 2.
Well, and I'll use this opportunity to pivot to your show, because what you've just said, you go into more detail on your podcast. So remind folks, what is the podcast? Where can they find it? And when do episodes come out?
It is called Contempt of Court. It is available wherever fine podcasts are not sold because it's free.
Wherever you're listening to this episode, assuming you're not listening to it on our website.
Spotify, Stitcher, whatever you like to use. Episodes come out every Tuesday over the summer. It's a limited series.
Do you have a set number? Limited. Do you know how many episodes it's going to be?
I think it's going to be 8. It might be.
Wow, that's Apple TV limited series.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If only I had Apple TV money, right? Short, sweet, and there might be 9 because I might do like a wrap-up episode.
Well, that would be fitting. One episode per justice.
Yeah, I'll just do... The 9th episode will be like, and then Ketanji Brown Jackson came and tried to fix everything.
Ugh.
Hasn't she been great? I mean, like, for people who haven't taken the time to either listen to her at oral arguments or read her dissents, she has been a force in her brief time on the court. And I think the reason why she's so good is that she uses originalist arguments all the goddamn time, right? So she uses their own arguments against them, right? She uses basic originalism, basic textualism to just bust them up. And it's fun to listen to. It's sad that, you know, she's going to be in the dissent for the rest of her life. But, like, it's fun to listen to.
She and Sotomayor, I feel like, are writing dissents that they know will be taken up. Like, maybe decades from now. Right. But they will be pulled up as a, like, okay, we're just going to go back to this, which should have been the majority of it.
They're writing dissents so they know that there were people at the time who disagreed.
Yeah, there's a record. Yes. All right. Contempt of Court is the podcast. We encourage you to check it out. In addition to this one, I'm sorry to hear that it's a limited series. I expect it will not be your only limited series.
Man, you're trying to get me killed, man. There's only so many hours in a day.
Well, a final question then, because this will tee up what the need for a limited series next year. Upcoming term starts in October. What are you anticipating? Other than more carnage.
Well, there's the case that they're trying to use to undo the 16th Amendment, which is the income tax amendment. Moore v. United States this time. It should be a huge one. And, you know, I've been saying what's happening this summer is that all the people who take all the justices out on trips got them on their yachts and are telling them about Moore v. United States and how important it is to rule against the 16th Amendment. Like, that's what they're doing all summer, right? They ain't talking to me. They're not talking to Bernie Sanders. They're talking to Harlan Crow and the Horatio Alger Society about dismantling the federal income tax constitutional amendment. So, like, looking forward to that. And I'm also really, people are really head up about U.S. v. Rahimi. That's the case where the Fifth Circuit said the domestic abusers can keep their guns. I'm worried about it, but I'm not apoplectic about it yet because there's still a chance that the Fifth Circuit got it so completely wrong that the court took it up to overturn it, right? We were talking about the four votes needed to grant cert. We don't get to know who those four votes are. And I could see, I'm not saying that this is what happened, but I'm saying I could see that three of those four votes being the liberals, all women, by the way, being like, nah. So I don't know that that's going to be the horrible one. The other one that I'm keeping an eye on, obviously, is the Mifepristone case, the abortion pill case. The Fifth Circuit is right now ruling on the merits. You know, I imagine that as soon as they do, that will be immediately appealed to SCOTUS. I imagine that SCOTUS will schedule that next term, you know, late next term, you know, like March, April. But I imagine SCOTUS will schedule that next term and we'll have a actual abortion pill ruling on the merits. And you want to talk about fake cases. I mean, people forget that the entire theory behind the abortion pill challenge is that women who take the abortion pill are super sad. And that somehow grants them Supreme Court status. Not the women who have taken it, because none of the women who have taken it are actually suing. Like, doctors who don't prescribe the abortion pill believe that the abortion pill makes people sad. And so that gives them standing. And so far, the Supreme Court's like, yeah, okay, that's cool.
Well, again, this term was nothing if not proof that standing is whatever the justices say standing is.
Yeah, so I'm very worried about that.
And then lastly, this is more personal than this topic, but what do you make of the First Amendment case that's come down recently saying that the government can't talk to social media companies?
I expect that to get overturned. I really do. When I say the Fifth Circuit is wilding out, I mean, like, they're just... They are throwing spaghetti at the wall at this point. And I just, it's the same thing. Basically, it's the same thing I'm saying with Rahimi. Like, yes, there's a chance the Supreme Court's like, yeah, cool. But I think there's also a real good chance the Supreme Court's like, this is a bit dumb. Because the Fifth Circuit is just, they're not, it's almost like the Fifth Circuit is not a court anymore. It's an audition space, right? It's like the chorus line for future Supreme Court justices.
That's a really good musical. Don't
this job. So I don't know that case is going to hold up. But you know, if he had me on 2 years ago, I would be like, this Texas bounty hunting bill is certainly gonna, right? And
well, that's why, like, any case, I'm just like, don't write it off. There's always a chance.
Yep. With these crazy fools, there's always a chance.
Well, I look forward to your podcast, Ellie, and we will certainly have you back on to talk about whatever happens next term.
Absolutely. Let's talk to you soon.
Thank you again to Ellie Mistal for joining me for our final episode on the Supreme Court's term. If you missed any of our recent episodes debriefing some of the biggest SCOTUS decisions of the term, now is a great time to check those out wherever you are listening to this episode. Make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law and hashtag Broken Law Podcast. You can also find our episodes and show notes on our website, acslaw.org/podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.